I mean, watches are a huge, huge story point for props people. It not only tells you like what time it is in the scene, which like T minus 10 minutes until the bomb explodes. What is that piece? Is that a new watch? Is it expensive? If it's expensive, the character probably has money. A watch is very personal aesthetic choice. I think a lot of people that have watches, it's definitely a character for them as well.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. We've got a fun old school episode for you today. First up, I sit down with Jack and James to get an inside look at some of the best stories from the last few weeks. We've got an obituary written in tribute to an aviation giant, the story of a racing legend and his extremely elegant chronograph, and a deep dive into one of history's more esoteric timekeepers. Jack is Jack, James is James, and it's a pretty fun conversation. After that, you'll hear our own Danny Milton's conversation with Hollywood prop master Maria Simonelli, who has worked on projects ranging from a slew of Stephen King adaptations to five seasons of Suits to a new Guillermo del Toro project that I'm already getting excited for. There are plenty of personal anecdotes that you'll want to stick around for, but Simonelli also explains to Danny why she thinks watches are so personal and so important to properly developing a character. I really hope you enjoy this two-parter. So without further ado, let's do this. This week's episode is presented by Grand Seiko and the 9S A5 movement. Stay tuned later in the show to learn about this innovative new caliber or visit grandseiko.us.com for more. Hey guys, how you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah, same here. Pretty good.
Yeah, Jack and I just got off a long conference call together. I haven't talked to you in a while, James. It's been way too long.
Yeah, it's been a minute, man.
How are things up in Canada?
Things in Canada are fine, you know, cold, quiet.
Yeah. All right. So Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the most part.
Perfect. Well, I wanted to get the two of you guys on the show this week because we've had a lot of news and just a lot, like some thematic trends, I would say, on the site recently that you two have spearheaded. So I thought we could talk through a little bit of the newsy stuff and then go over some of the bigger themes that have been running through the site lately. That sound okay?
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. Let's start off with the bummer and get it out of the way. And that is that we were recording this just a couple days after Chuck Yeager died. And I mean, like, I saw this scrolling through Instagram. I actually saw it. Jason Heaton posted it on his Instagram. And I immediately texted Nick and was like, we have to get a story together for this. And Jack, you ended up writing the obit here. And I wonder, for people who are not obsessed with Chuck Yeager and obsessed with kind of like mid-century aviation, can you give us the like TLDR version of why Chuck Yeager matters and kind of what you think the legacy is that would be interesting to our audience?
I mean, I think the frame that, was, kind of built around him in the book, The Right Stuff, really kind of, sums up what he was and why he was important. He was an explorer, right? These were guys who were going places and doing things. The test pilots of his generation were going places and doing things, often at, cost of life and limb that, nobody else was doing. And he was, when he broke the sound barrier in 47, I think it was, he was the fastest man alive. And, the crazy thing is everybody thought that something terrible would happen, when you broke the sound barrier in an aircraft. And like really nothing terrible happened. It was like a relatively smooth transition for him, but nobody knew, and being the first person to go someplace like that takes a certain amount of guts. What I liked about writing the obit and what I kind of liked about Yeager was that despite his reputation as a daredevil, he was actually an extremely cautious guy. Like he obsessed about safety. He obsessed about understanding what the limits of his aircraft were and his own physical limits. And I mean, yeah, he pushed the limits for a living, but he always made darn sure he knew where they were and what the potential cost might be for, for going past them. So like, this combination of being very daring and very smart, I mean, that's an amazing thing.
Yeah. I mean, James, for you, do you have any sort of like, I mean, anything that you want to kind of contribute that was personally like meaningful or moving for you about Chuck Yeager?
No, I never got so lucky to have seen him fly. I'm a little on the young side, I think. I was going to air shows when I was a kid, but they were, you know, rural stuff up here around Toronto. It would have been a treat to see him fly. I mean, in many ways, he was probably... It's hard to compare them to an athlete, like a Michael Jordan or something like that, simply because like that's a professional attribute, whereas these guys, you know, they were operating for and under the purview of the military, typically, and other governmental bodies. But as far as a natural pilot goes, he's probably the greatest natural pilot of all time, at least that people are aware of, right? Part of that is aligning with the golden era of flight and the discovery of flight and, you know, the great kind of pedestals that they hit on the way to going to the moon. He exists. We got to the moon because of guys like this and his peers. And what I like about this is, this is a guy that spent his entire life flirting with death, and he lived to be 97.
Yeah, that's I mean, pretty impressive. I mean, if you had told people in the 1940s that Chuck Yeager was going to die peacefully at the age of 97, I think people would have laughed you out of the room. But he made it, man. The guy did it.
Yeah, the amazing thing about one of the many amazing things about Chuck Yeager is, he's stereotypically characterized as, quote, a natural born stick and rudder man. But he actually hated I always thought of him that way too, but he personally hated the idea of being, a natural pilot. And, you know, he said at one point in his memoir, there is no such thing as a natural pilot. If the best pilots are the ones who fly the most, you fly a lot, you get good at it. And the first time he went up in an airplane, he barfed all over the front seat of the pilot in front of him. And he said in his memoir, he had to work like super, super hard at being a good pilot. And if he was good, it was just because he worked harder than most of the other guys.
That's great.
You know, but that said, there's got to be some natural talent in there too.
Yeah, I think so for sure. I mean, this is such a like nonsense anecdote, but I'm going to share it anyway because I have a microphone in front of me. So why the hell not? But my sort of like first experience of Chuck Yeager and first like hearing about him was actually in high school. I had a physics teacher in high school, Mr. Pace, shout out to Mr. Pace, who was obsessed with Chuck Yeager. And like growing up, this guy grew up in like a trailer park in West Texas. And like all he wanted to be was Chuck Yeager when he grew up. But the problem was he grew up to be 6'6" and about 280 pounds. Which means you cannot be a test pilot. So instead, he was a high school physics teacher. But every like problem on every exam was always like, if Chuck Yeager is flying, Bell X1 at X speed, and like that was that's, my early experience of Chuck Yeager was doing my physics homework in high school. Yeah. But I think he's one of those guys who lived and will continue to live on in the popular imagination as kind of like people at their best, people pushing what it means to be a human being and, what we can accomplish as a civilization. So I'm glad we were able to get a story up so quickly and such a thoughtful, kind of interesting treatment, Jack.
Oh, yeah. Big, huge Rolex guy.
Huge Rolex guy, which like I will, we'll link it up in the show notes, but everybody should go check out the photo of him wearing an early Big Crown sub. I don't think it's possible to look cooler wearing a watch than the way he wears that watch, personally.
I couldn't agree more.
All right, we're going to go to another sort of like speed-related story here, and we don't have to get too in-depth. This is one I think you really need to read and kind of like soak in to fully appreciate. And that's John Reardon's story that he wrote for us about Carroll Shelby's Patek Philippe from the 1959 Le Mans. It's a 1463. It's a gold, like absolutely beautiful mid-century chronograph. And yet it has this incredible connection to racing history. I don't know. I just like imagining this watch as like the definition of quote unquote a sports watch at the time tells me like everything you need to know about that being a completely different world than the world we live in now.
Yeah, in the idea of the gentleman driver, right, which was still a thing in the 50s. Yeah. There were people running in Le Mans who financed their own way and brought a car and figured their car could last for 24 hours, which is a ridiculous thing to figure most of the time.
Yeah.
You could take the car from your driveway today and attempt to drive 24 hours flat out. You're not getting anywhere. Definitely not going to run for 24 hours. But they were doing it. And I mean, like Shelby, it's funny that we have, you know, Shelby died a few years back and is an icon in, I would say, a few different genres, including chili. If you know enough about him, he was like a chili magnate, in his years after, you know, destroying Ferrari's entire legacy at Le Mans. And then before that, winning Le Mans himself in a British car, despite being an American. I think much like Jaeger, we're looking at like an icon of a post-war American. You know, this guy was maybe a little bit more controversial to his several ex-wives than Jaeger would have been. But I mean, a remarkable dude. And the lead photo, which is one I'm proud to have found on Getty that we ran, is him in the hat, I think in 1965 or 66. With the watch on his wrist, which I don't believe we know to be that common. Yeah. You don't see him. Also, he wore a watch on different wrists, so photos can be kind of hard to judge. Sometimes he had him on the right, sometimes he had him on left. My guess would be that would depend on whether or not he was physically driving a car or working in proving a car, which would have had a lot of them would have had a sill shifter. So if he liked to wear his watch on the right wrist, you'd bang it into the edge of the car, which would just be bare metal for a lot of these vintage race cars. But yeah, you see, I mean, he was a guy that was photographed a lot and he always has like a certain swagger. But the fun thing about this is you guys can attest a lot of times you'll find either the watch is incredible and the celebrity sort of somewhere in the middle, or the celebrity's incredible and the watch is kind of somewhere in the middle. And this is that rare thing where they're both incredible. I mean, this is one of the most beautiful watches ever made. It could absolutely be somebody's only watch. And it's so of an era, you know. Eventually, of course, they would be giving out Rolexes, Daytonas, you know, quite commonly when you win at a race that's sponsored by Rolex, usually Sebring, you get a Daytona, and it's usually a weird one. But there's, you know, there's race car drivers today that have 20, 30 of these strange, you know, racing win, they're engraved on the back. And I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I think it's Scott Pruitt, a race car driver. I think he said in one race he won 4 Daytonas because he was a marshal of some sort. He's a very long-standing and very talented endurance race car driver in general. And he had one for being a marshal, one for having the fastest time in qualifying, one for something else, and one for winning the race. Like, I'm sure maybe it wasn't 4, maybe it's 3, maybe it's 5. I don't remember, but you can win more than one if you're operating at a certain level. And back in the day, that was, like an insanely collectible vintage Patek Philippe.
Yeah. I think currently at the 24 hours, you know, at Daytona 24, it's a two-tone Daytona.
Hmm. I mean, that's a weird choice, but also like kind of a hell of a trophy.
Yeah,
and
for
it's
sure.
A trophy you can carry around, like not carry around, but like wear around on a daily basis, which I've always thought is like a cool thing. Despite not being a racing fan myself, it is one of the things I have always found to be like kind of enticing about the idea.
Hey, James, if you had to give like an elevator speech on what happened to the gentleman driver, what would it be?
Just corporate money. Like racing became something where brands felt that they could prove entire models. You know, the idea of win on Sunday, sell on Monday became a real thing, especially because of Shelby. Like Shelby specifically and Lee Iacocca and the folks at Ford when they set out to, you know, essentially settle the score with Enzo Ferrari after the partnership between the two companies failed. And that led to the story that you can see in the movie Ford versus Ferrari or read in the vastly better book Go Like Hell by A.J. Bame. My guess is that it still exists at some level, but the gentleman driver is this weird, like almost you're either like you race in lemons where you have $500 to prep the entire car aside from your safety and you run that for 24 hours and it's just meant to be fun. Or on the other side, you have, you know, people who have the money to buy into single mark race series, like Ferrari does this with the FXX series. And that's essentially a car that you buy from Ferrari and then they hold on to it. And it has a team of people and a tractor or a tractor trailer, and you kind of tell them where you're going to go and they'll bring it there and they'll set up the food for you as well. And all this kind of stuff. It's like a different world where you don't really have these races where someone could just kind of buy a modern sports car. Like you're not going out and buying a GT 86 or a BRZ or something, and then putting a bit of money into it and going to attempt to running it at a professional level. There's still stages of racing that accept that sort of thing, but there's more licensing now. There's more safety now. There's more scrutineering. There's way more rules to get into a race like Le Mans, especially these races where you have multiple multiple classes of vehicle, because you have to know if you're driving in GT class, you have to know what those headlights are behind you and why they're coming up so quickly, because you're not the fastest car and you want to be out of people's way. So I don't know if it's the same thing where you might want someone who had never done a lap of the Le Mans course to show up and attempt to be doing that next to cars that now are, you know, Toyota and Porsche and, you know, big names that are running cars that'll go flat out, literally flat out for 24 hours. They have to change drivers. They don't change cars.
If you're driving a prototype at the 24 hours of Daytona, you don't necessarily want somebody who's like, you know,
you don't want me. You don't want me in an Aston Martin Vantage that I bought, you know, that I bought secondhand, right, and it just barely passed scrutineering, you know, maybe blowing a coolant line and covering the track with a bunch of garbage that takes hours to get rid of or causes a crash or something like that. So,
yeah.
But it's a crazy world, and really, anything about Shelby, the story's always fun. The guy was a complete hothead and super talented driver, and something of like a car whisperer. I mean, to take on Ferrari at the time in the 60s was really a ridiculous thing to do, even if you had the deuce essentially writing blank checks the whole process the whole way through. But I mean, look, that also bred into, that's a name brand that is still attached to cars today. Ford still sells Shelby class vehicles. And my guess is we'll see it move right into electric cars too, which I don't know what Shelby would have thought about that. With the Mach-E coming up and being part of their new performance platform. And it'll be interesting to see if they do a Shelby version of the Mach-E, because they're still making Shelby versions of the Mustang. You know, they have a few of them, 350s and the 500s.
Yeah.
But they're definitely not, Patek's not making watches like this anymore. If, you know, Ford's doing their best to continue making cars like that. But, you know, 1463 is a special thing.
1463 has to be in the conversation for like one of the greatest watches of all time, no?
I think so. Yep.
Jack, what do you think?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any argument about that at all. Certainly not from me.
Yeah. All right. Well, the last thing I want to talk about is this is our kind of wild card story, which is Jack's Culture of Time story about chess clocks and the Queen's Gambit. You know, the Queen's Gambit, for people who aren't familiar, limited series on Netflix. About a mid-century chess player. It's about a lot more than that. We're not going to get too deep into like what the show is about. No spoilers, all of that. But Jack saw this and decided to go as deep as he possibly could on chess clocks, which is not a thing I'd ever thought about covering on the site, which I guess is a good sign. But yeah, Jack, what led you down this rabbit hole, and what were some of the like craziest things you learned while there?
I mean, I remember when Bobby Fischer was, you know, kind of an international superstar. And, you know, like kids of my generation, there was a period where it was 50-50 whether you wanted to grow up to be the next Bobby Fischer or you wanted to be an astronaut. You know, it was just like a super, super cool thing to be. He was, you know, kind of against Boris Spassky for the world championship in Reykjavik. You know, he was kind of a cold warrior. And the chess clocks were part of that, you know, like banging on the button. You know, when you completed your move, working under the clock, you know, being cool under pressure, being able to think 10, 15, 20 moves ahead, which, you know, I certainly can't do. And like, you know, the chess clock is, I mean, for me, chess clocks are kind of like the speed masters of the, you know, mental combat realm. You know, like the speed masters that watch the went to the moon, but like chess clocks represent, you know, a different kind of combat, right? Still like, you know, the cold warriors, but the ultimate test of cerebral fitness, as the you know, as the song used to say. And they're wonderful things. They have been largely superseded by digital timing devices, you know, like pretty much everything else, because there's so many different possible timing rules under which chess games can operate. There's an amazing quote in the story, which I think is true. It's not all analog chess clocks are beautiful, but all beautiful chess clocks are analog, from Chess Life, 2012. And I really feel like that's true. There's something about there's something visceral about the ticking and, you know, just hitting the buttons. It's it feels like a fencing match.
The same could be said about watches.
Yeah, I would agree with that, James. I think that's a good point. Yeah, I think there's something really interesting to me about chess clocks, about the way you engage with them. Like, you know, Jack, you describe them in the story as almost like a seesaw, right? Like this like you and the opponent across from you have this timekeeping device that is sort of your link to one another. And the motion of reaching for it and hitting the button on the top and like the hands stopping and starting and having these two competing units of time. Like, I don't know. It's really strange for us to have a timekeeping mechanism that's not just interactive between the one user and one mechanism, but it's two users and one mechanism that is sort of like two mechanisms linked. Like I don't know. It's a weird way to interact with timekeeping. And I don't know. There's something about it that I find really like poetic and compelling.
I like that it puts the two times in competition with each other.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun. You know, you get two displays, two buttons. You're not sharing anything. It's like an extension of the player and their side of the board. It's cool.
I mean, speaking of Bobby Fischer, that was one of the things he was, you know, really notorious for. There's a whole psychological warfare aspect to, you know, playing chess at that level. And I mean, you know, he indulged himself in all sorts of behaviors that were basically calculated to irritate his opponents to the point where they wouldn't be able to concentrate properly. And, you know, I remember learning to play chess when I was 5 years old. And I played against my dad a lot of the time, and he was the most annoying person to play chess with because, you know, he was fond of banging the pieces down on the board when he made a move as hard as he possibly could as a way of kind of, you know, like rattling his opponent, like, you know, like his 5-6-year-old kid. Fischer would do the same thing. He would like, he'd show up late. He would like, you know, at the last minute say, oh, wait, I'm not going to, you know, play in this match unless there's an extra $100,000 in it for me. I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff. And, you know, Spassky was, you know, came from a generation of Russian players who were like, they were basically being paid by the government to play chess at a super high level. And, you know, the side effect of that was like, they were professionals in a way that, you know, somebody like Fischer was not, and, you know, and poor Boris Spassky, he was like, what is this guy's problem?
Amazing. Yeah. I just highly recommend everybody, whether you're interested in chess or not, whether you've watched the Queen's Gambit or not, go check this story out. It's just like, it's a perfect case of a weird way in which timekeeping pops up in popular culture and sort of the like insane historical story lurking just below the surface. And Jack, I, you know, if I can say so, I think you did a really good job teasing this out and making it a sort of like fun, approachable topic.
Thanks.
'Cause I also don't know if I had seen on, you know, some other news or website somewhere, you know, a headline like, everything you need to know about chess clocks. Like, I probably would not have clicked that if I'm being totally honest, but yeah, I enjoyed it here.
Yeah, it was a fun story to work on. You know, there's a fantasy to being, you know, about kind of being discovered as a child prodigy, right? Like your destiny is mapped out for you. You're a genius at math. And, you know, you go to Princeton and get your first PhD when you're 14 years old. You're a genius at chess. And, you know, you sweep the floor with the competition by the time you're 18. And, you know, for people of my generation, finding out that you were actually a child prodigy chess player, I mean, it was my generation's equivalent of getting your, like, letter from Hogwarts, you know?
Amazing. Love that. You also got a letter from Hogwarts, right?
Alas.
All right. Thanks for doing this, guys. I mean, we have like, you know, we made a list of stories we wanted to touch on. There were like 10 of them, but we sadly don't have time to get through all of them. So we'll save a few for the next go around. But yeah, Chuck Yeager, Carol Shelby, and the Queen's Gambit, all excellent stories. They're all linked up in the show notes. And thank you guys for sharing. Really appreciate it.
Ton of fun. Thanks for having us on the show, Steven.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Up next, we've got Danny Milton's conversation with Hollywood prop master Maria Simonelli.
Hey, Hey everybody, Danny Milton here, and today I am talking watches and the movies with Maria Simonelli, who has worked as both an assistant prop master and prop master on a variety of projects in both film and television, everything from Suits to Shazam. She's now working on a film right now directed by Guillermo del Toro. Hey Maria, thanks for joining me today and having a conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I think for our audience, just sort of if you want to tell them a little bit about yourself, you know, what it is you do in the movie business, I think everyone would be pretty excited to hear about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I am assistant property master. We call it here in Toronto on-set key. So my job is basically to handle all the props as the head of department on set and to go through with the actors, check with the director that everything is what they wanted, all their concepts for any designs, make sure that all those things work in the scene. And then I workshop that with the actors on the day of or sometimes days before, depending on what the prop is. And then I just maintain continuity and resets and just make sure that everything looks good and looks the way that it's supposed to. So like I polish things or move it on the table to make sure that it matches for all the different setups we do.
So when you say workshop things with actors, I think I'd like to dig deep into that a little bit more. What does that mean exactly? So I don't know, you can give an example of a specific prop maybe from your own experience. Like what does that kind of entail?
Okay, I think I can't recall what the name of the actual prop was, but for example, I worked on The Expanse for the first three seasons, and a show like that would have a lot of props that are made up concepts to suit whatever the future needs would be of that prop. A cast member, Dominique Tipper, and I, she was like an electrical engineer for the ship.
Okay.
And so we had, you know, things that would come out of the ship's side that she would have to physically place discs in or turn a certain way. And when it's things like that and it's really tactile, it's helpful to show them exactly how it's going to work, to save them on the day, not really understanding what it is, but then also to make sure that, you know, the pieces fit their hands properly or that it's comfortable for them to turn something a certain way if they're going to be doing it 100 times in a take.
So for something like that too, how does that get conceived? So is that something that the props department figures out? We are inventing something that doesn't exist. This is a future object. And you have to figure, so there's two things, I guess there's two questions. A, how do you even know what you're telling the actor how to do with something that doesn't exist? So what are the conversations that happen before that for something like that?
Yeah, for sure. So again, on a show like The Expanse, the writers are literally there all the time, like the writers of the books and the writers of the show. So something like that would be conceptually discussed in prep. The prop master of the show would then there could be schematics or drawings, or it could just be, you know what, like I'm gonna just go and do a build. Or a lot of times what happens now is because 3D printing is so accessible, like on a show I worked on, Star Trek Discovery, and you know, we have literally 3D printers just outside of the props office to do conceptual designs. To then show them to make sure they fit the cast, a lot of phasers, guns, things like that, make sure that they fit the cast that's going to be using them, and then sometimes actually taking those 3D prints and using them or taking them to a builder. There's some, you know, build shops in Toronto. Walter Klassen's FX is just absolutely wonderful, the things that they can do. So whether it's 3D printing it, modifying it, painting it, whether it's, having digitally somebody in the art department would do the schematics, send those to a builder, then the builder inputs them, then they start building. So there's definitely a lot that goes into it from somebody's brain or, you know, like a director like Guillermo del Toro, for example, he draws everything out for us. So he would draw stuff and hand them to my boss. And then my boss would be like, okay, I think I understand. Let me now go and try to make that thing. And then
okay.
With you multiple times in show and tells before it actually goes to camera.
So I've spoken to some prop masters in the past, and the show and tells come up pretty often. So how much of a show and tell from a prop department perspective is the props department, after having maybe meetings with the screenwriter, the director, in some cases they're the same person, are you all trying to show like, this is what we came up with on our own versus these are things we found that the director specifically wants in the film?
It kind of depends. I mean, typically, well, it depends on your director. It depends on the project. You know, most of the times the directors are pretty specific as to what they want. Like for Guillermo, a lot of times actually certain props come from things that he already owns that he's like, I want to use this thing. Here's one of them, but we need to make more than one. And we might need to have it as like a rubber if like there's a stunt or there's going to be rain and you don't want it to get broken or, and you don't certainly don't want to break his stuff.
Right.
So, you know, so you can kind of make other things that look exactly like what he's presented to you. And then other times, you know, you can be really creative. There's also the job of a props buyer. And the bot, you know, sometimes you really luck out. I've bought on certain things and I've been like, maybe the director will like this, I'm not sure. And then that's the thing they pick and you're like, wow, now this is going to be handled in this movie that I'm going to watch. And so you never really know. It kind of depends. You can get the sort of verbal instructions and then, you know, just find that thing. Or sometimes it takes many, many, many passes to really get that one thing, that special thing to come to fruition.
This week's episode is presented by Grand Seiko. There are lots of things to like about Grand Seiko watches, from their distinctive case designs to their otherworldly dials that are unlike any others on the market today. But the Japanese watchmaker also sets itself apart under the hood with innovative movements that push the boundaries of what fine watchmaking can be. The latest instance of this? The new Caliber 9S A5. This is Grand Seiko's latest generation of automatic mechanical movement, created to celebrate the company's 60th anniversary this year. At first glance, it looks very much like automatic movements you might already know, with a clearly visible balance wheel suspended from an arched bridge and a swinging rotor to keep the movement ticking away. But tons of engineering has gone into making the 9S A5 a caliber that can be as precise as possible for as long as possible, delivering the very best experience to the wearer. To achieve this, Grand Seiko created a whole new type of high-beat escapement, the dual impulse escapement, which is extremely efficient and has low friction to reduce wear and tear. Part of this is a new free-sprung balance with an overcoil hairspring to optimize performance in every position. And importantly, Grand Seiko developed a new horizontal gear train, allowing the 9S A5 to be 15% slimmer than previous high-beat movements, meaning it can be utilized in a broader range of watch styles. It's this kind of thinking that draws from the past but looks to the future, that sets Grand Seiko apart from the competition. And if you ever find yourself wondering if there's still real, meaningful innovation to be done in mechanical watchmaking, the 9S A5 is the answer you've been looking for. To learn more about the Caliber 9S A5 and Grand Seiko's 60th anniversary, be sure to visit grandseiko.us.com. All right, let's get back to the show.
So let's talk a little bit about watches on film. You know, from some of the projects maybe that you've worked on, I know that I immediately, when I saw your IMDb page before we even met or started talking, I saw that you'd worked on Suits. I saw that you worked on It Chapter 2. Mm-hmm. And just immediately in my head, I'm thinking, well, in the case of It Chapter 2, you've got sort of a dual storytelling operation in that film where you've got the children's story in the 80s and you've got the adult story in pseudo present time. And then Suits, obviously you're working in sort of the high powered world of lawyers. And so I don't know if you have any specific, you know, stories about watches that come to mind, or if not, just, you know, generally what it's like as a prop master or assistant prop master, and what role you think watches play sort of in general.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I mean, watches are, and timepieces are a huge, huge story point for props people. And I think a lot of it, you know, it's like the question would be like, well, why isn't a watch costumes? And it's like, well, because a watch tells a story. It not only tells you like what time it is in the scene, which like, you know, can matter depending on what, you know, what you're doing. If it's a scene where, you know, you've got T-minus 10 minutes until the bomb explodes. You know, somebody's checking their watch every 2 minutes, you know, the director might want to cut in on that specific piece. And then it's, what is that piece? And then is that a new watch? Is it expensive? It's, if it's expensive, the character probably has money. If it's an old watch and it's all rickety, maybe it's an heirloom piece. Why are they choosing to wear that watch? Because even for people, you know, a watch is an aesthetic, very personal aesthetic choice. I think a lot of people that have watches, it's definitely a character for them as well. You know, it says quite a lot about you.
Sure.
So yeah, like, I mean, in the world of suits, you know, you've got, let's say like a Mike Ross versus a Louis Litt. So you've got a Mike Ross character who has like a, you know, a crappy old Timex. And I remember when I started the show, cause I believe I came in on season 3, you know, I was like, oh, it's like Mike has this like crummy Timex watch that he still wears even though he's making more money. So it shows you that like Mike doesn't care about the stature of being a lawyer. He cares about helping people. Whereas somebody like a Louis Litt character, I believe he wore a Patek Philippe, but for props people, it's very difficult to carry a Patek Philippe in A, your budget, and B, on in your kit that would have to be in a safe, like locked up. So I believe that his was a knockoff. I know it was a knockoff. But that was only for like our purposes of like safety and making sure that, you know, you're not stressing out every day that your X amount of dollar watch is going to get, you know, broken or lost or whatever.
Sure.
So you know, you've kind of got, and, you know, like Lewis is big and flashy. Mike's just, you know, something he wears every day because he's worn it for X amount of years. Whereas, you know, we talked about on the show, The Expanse, Thomas Jane wears a watch, and he was very insistent on wearing a timepiece, even though in that world, watches are obsolete. So you don't need a watch because, you know, it's darkness all the time. You know, unless you're on Earth, it's like, you don't really need that timepiece. So, and Thomas's was funny because we had sourced it from Fossil, but it had like a screen face, but then also it had like little kind of numbers beside it. It was all metallic with a gray leather band, but it never worked. So like in the show, it was never practical. So you knew that you know, Miller wore this watch for a reason, but it was never to tell time. So what is this watch? What does it mean to him? Why does he insist on wearing it? You know, he's supposed to be like this noir detective in this like sci-fi universe. So he always had his watch on him all the time. And it was just, yeah, like things like that. It's interesting to kind of see the, you know, who wants to wear what and why as like an actor, but then also there's also the character beat of sometimes, you know, well, your character has this watch and this watch, you know, it's in the script that this watch is extremely important.
Do those things ever conflict where an actor is insistent on wearing a watch or maybe has external forces which require that he can only wear a certain watch, maybe some kind of brand deal, and how, maybe what are the behind the scenes politics that go into dealing with that, you know, and maybe that's a period piece where the watch is very not period correct, you know, yeah. Something like that. Are there ever like situations where things like that come up?
Yeah, definitely. I haven't really experienced it too much where somebody's just like, no, I can't, or I have to wear this particular piece. And then typically that would be like a director actor discussion. Like we wouldn't, if somebody doesn't want to wear something, we wouldn't force them to wear it. I have a character on the show I'm working on now. I won't say who it is because I don't want to give things away because it's not out yet. But we had sourced a watch for them, a very, very beautiful watch that does play in the actual script as like, you know, sync your watches and, you know, but they didn't ever want to wear it. They just thought, well, this isn't, my character, I don't think she ever would really care about that. And it's, and I, you know, and then it's just, you know, in that case, it's just a you know, a discussion with the director, and it's a yes or a maybe you should wear it, but it's never like a total issue. But it's funny when we do source things and you know, they cost money and you know, it has to look a certain way, and our buyers look, my, you know, my boss looks, or I'll look, and we find something really great, and then the cast is just like, you know what, I don't think my character would wear a watch, and you're like, oh, okay, cool, I only spent, it's fine, it was really hard to get, but it's like, okay, cool, like, you know, you don't sweat stuff, you can't sweat stuff like that or take it personally when something doesn't get used or when
right. I spent weeks and you have no idea what I was doing trying to source that piece, but no problem, I'll just give it back.
Especially a vintage pieces, you know, and you know, like I said, the project I'm on now, I know it's public that it takes place in, you know, the 30s and the 40s. So sourcing for that was really important for Hero Watches, to find things that would suit the character, but that were also actually vintage. And that was really hard. And our buyer came through big time for us on that, because it was, I can't believe he found three watch faces from, you know, 1915, like that are all matches. It was just, right. Wow. So that was pretty cool. And yeah, so, you know, sometimes, cast members also have like pre-existing relationships with brands as well. And so we get product placement. I worked on a Stephen King show called 11-22-63, and the lovely and talented Sarah Gadden, she had a deal with, and I might mispronounce, but I believe it's Jaeger LeCoultre.
It's pretty close. That's not bad.
I didn't butcher it. Okay.
There's like 80 different ways to pronounce that and a whole host of different watch brand names. So don't even worry about it.
Okay. Yeah. And she had a very, very beautiful watch that they gave us. It was quite expensive. That was, I think, one of the most like real expensive watches that I was in charge of constantly locking away. So
what's the process of sourcing a piece like that? So now that the budget allows you to get, you know, a watch of that stature, what's the process? Are you working directly with that brand to get that, or is it something, it's a vintage piece that's being sourced from a watch dealer? What goes into that process, if you're aware for that piece?
Yeah. I mean, it just varies. Sometimes like we have like a clearance department. So sometimes the clearance department gets approached, like, so if there's a big feature coming or there's a cast member, you know, somebody like Sarah is, you know, she's a really big name. And so, you know, people want to style her. So we would get emails and requests. But if like the cast members also are like, you know, hey, I was kind of, you know, you do fittings with them and they're like, I was kind of thinking, you know, I like this brand. Maybe we could like contact them.
Okay.
And then you also have brands like Hamilton, for example.
Sure.
They've been around forever. So, you know, they also, you know, will re-release things like, so we've actually had a timepiece in our kit now that is a match to one of the ones that the 1915 styles that they've just re-released this year. So wow. In that case, it's like, then it's great because it becomes like something that we originally got from, you know, from 1915, 1920 is now being re-released. So it's really easy to get parts for it. So things like that happen as well, where you're kind of able to, it's like, you know, because time, you know, watches are so, excuse my pun, but timeless, you know, right. And a lot sure. of, time, you know, things get designs get recycled because they're just so classic. So that happens as well.
You talked a little bit about, especially for, I think it's the current project you're working on, you said that you needed three different watch dials. So talk a little bit about, as you know, either an assistant prop master or prop master, the need to have multiples of something. What's the reason that you need that? And what's the utility behind that, you know, from a practical perspective?
Yeah, I mean, So you know, you always have to have doubles for props. If you have one of the thing, and that one thing breaks, or that one thing gets lost somehow, that one thing gets misplaced, you know, then you don't have that thing anymore. And that's really right. So depending on what it is, you know, but typically anything, if we categorize something as hero, which means that it's that, that plays for the cast member, that's something that's very important to them. That's something they wear every day, or it's something that plays in a scene that is like, you know, it tells part of the story. So we'll label it as hero, and those items will double. So, you know, like I said, you know, something that you are able to find, you know, that's vintage, you know, you have to have two that look the same, as best as you can. And I know I will speak to Bradley Cooper, who's in this film I'm in now. He likes to have that one thing, to be the same all the time. So he's not like, we have doubles for him, but he really likes to have that same thing, which is wonderful. It's part of his character, and I totally understand. However, if we're going to do a stunt, let's say, and he's got his watch on, we like to switch or give the stunter the stunt watch in case something happens, because, you know, you have to, and in that case, we have like stunt watches that are either, you know, depending on the show, you know, if it's a show that it's contemporary and you can buy three of the same watch, no problem, then the stunter will have the exact same watch. But when you're dealing with things that are builds, that are very specific, then you have to kind of, maybe the stunter might have a very close match, because you'll never, it's a stunter, so you'll never do a pop insert on their watch, but they need to certainly be wearing this watch.
Right.
Or ring, hero necklace, things like that. So we have the hero item. And then, you know, I've worked with other cast members that are, you know, that are less into that attention to detail. As long as they have the watch that's kind of like the watch, or as long as they have the ring on the right finger, they're like, I'm fine. So okay. It sort of just depends. And it's fine either way. You know, for me, whatever gets the job done for them is like, I just want to make their world easier. And if a cast member feels more comfortable always having that same one thing, it just means we have to be extra specially careful. And there needs to be a discussion if there's going to be a stunt, or if they're, you know, they're doing a scene where, you know, they might bump up against something and it might get broken, then it would have to be a discussion, or if it's raining, or, you know what I mean? Like things that if it might get ruined, that's when it's a discussion to say, hey, you know, because if this thing does get ruined, like we have to fix it. And then for the next like couple of days, you're going to be wearing that other watch that you don't like.
Right. Okay.
So yeah. So then it just has to be a discussion. But
that's really interesting, actually. I wouldn't even have thought of that before.
Yeah. It's a very thing I really love about props is that they're very character motivated. And for certain cast members, it's a really personal thing. Which kind of creates a nice sort of working relationship, because I get it and they get it, but some people who don't work in props, like they don't get it. And then I'm just like, wait, why don't you get it?
Right. For
and
sure.
The cast member is like, wait, why don't you get it? I'm like, I got you. Don't worry.
I'm
like,
with you. We're on the same
wavelength. We're on the same page here. Yeah.
So from, I think we talked about this previously, but what's your take on prop masters in general? Are they usually watch people? And then secondarily, are you a watch person? Do you wear a watch normally? So, you know, either or.
So yes, it's very funny. Like in my experience, like prop masters are really, really funny with glasses, with watches, with any badges, like any cop badges or flair. It's like, I think it just speaks to your sort of like, every props person has to have some form of OCD, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to like put the satisfying labels on the satisfying bins that are all the same color and that are all like arranged. You know, it's a very like our organizational processing is pretty funny to other people, except for to us, where we're like, there's no other way but to do it this way. But yeah, like my boss, Chris Geggy, I've worked with him on multiple features over the past few years. And yeah, he loves his watches and you know, knows a lot about watches. And, you know, we've all learned throughout the years, like how to take a watch, you know, watch face off, how to change a watch battery, how to take a battery out because you know it's very rare that when you're on set that you would have a watch that ticks, because then the lav would pick it up. And then also your time of day is constantly rotating and changing. So you never want to have, well, I mean, you never want to have a working watch.
Right.
And then switching watch bands. Also, that's a whole other thing. You need all these little tools for it. It's very meticulous. So
hey, I think our listeners are very well versed in the meticulous nature of removing and replacing watch bands, which can be nerve wracking depending on the scenario.
Yeah. For us, if a band breaks, it takes a second that, you know,
sure.
You got that little spring. It's like, and you have to have your little micro screwdrivers or your little tools, and you have your watch kit, and it's like a, but that's why you have the double, you see, then you just switch it quick.
Switch it out. And then you work on the other one in the background and switch it back when you need it. Right. You
know, yeah. Yeah.
So for you, you work pretty much on set. So I kind of think about it as like you're really involved in like the movie magic aspect of things. So can you talk to me a little bit about that? I think you'd mentioned there's a game you play with your friends sometimes when you're watching back films or project you've worked on, and you just like share that with the audience. But I thought that was super interesting.
Oh, well, I always like to play the game of where am I? Because a lot of times as a props person, when you're doing resets, it's like sometimes I'm hiding under that table. Sometimes I'm in that behind that door that looks like a closet. So that's always like a fun thing. And then I like to, anytime that there's I've had like on The Expanse, for example, I've had to wear like green screen gloves and do like helmet catches and things like that. So that's always fun too, where like somebody, you know, throws this thing and I'm like, hey, I was there catching that thing. That's actually me.
Right.
Yeah. So that's always kind of like a fun little thing, kind of make it a little bit more exciting. You know, I've got such great, like, supportive friends and family that watch what I do. And, I think for them, it's exciting and fun to like know all these little secrets about, see, that looks like it's outside, but really it was like on a green screen, or like, oh, see how we did that. Like I remember with I have a niece, and she was 8 when she saw Shazam, and I really wanted her, I thought she was old enough to watch it, but I really wanted to prep her for what she was going to see. There's a scene in the boardroom
yeah.
That's pretty violent, which was actually that was a reshoot, that because they wanted they wanted to have a little bit more violence in the movie. And that was when I saw that, I was like, wow, it's intense.
I warned my brother. I have a young nephew, and he's like, we're taking them to see Shazam. I was like, I saw it. Just be aware. Like, there's just one scene.
Yeah. And which is such a great dark scene. And I think made a lot of Savannah's like scariness really come out, which I really liked. But I had to warn my niece, and I said, so when you're seeing those monsters, I said, on set, remember I told you, They were funny men, and they didn't wear these green screen costumes. They wore these kind of like speckled ones, but I just said, they're just in these green costumes. And then they're moving around and they're like dancing, and it's actually very funny. So then when she watched it, I said, did the monster scare you? And she said, no, because I knew they were just funny men. So I'm trying to get her to understand too, that this is what movies are, you know, like, you know, to kind of understand what CGI actually is, and how, you know, I made the movie, so I'm here, don't be scared, it wasn't real. Right.
Like you're trying to make that connection to how you mentioned you watched movies as a child. You kind of watched them with the understanding, like, oh, I kind of want to know how this happened, not trying to feel like this is reality, but how did they do this, how did they create those monsters, knowing that they're creations, knowing that they were manufactured for the purpose of entertainment, which is a great way to think about things.
Yeah, and I certainly want like the people in my life to watch what I do, you know. So when she's quite a little bit older, you know, we'll get her watching it, and I'll just explain to her about, I'll show her pictures of me and Bill together and him in his costume and me hugging him. And she'll understand that that's an actor, mind you, a very wonderful, scary, terrifying performance, but that it's just a person. So.
Right. For a moment, I wasn't sure if you were talking about Bill Hader or Bill Skarsgård. So
Bill Skarsgård. I mean, both Bills are wonderful and dreamy and great. But yeah.
Yeah, so that must have been a great experience working on that film. Was there any and there might not have been, but I think I remember seeing at least James McAvoy's character wearing a watch throughout the movie. I don't know if there's any story behind that or not.
No, I mean, with James was pretty, he was particular about his choices, but I mean, and he was interesting, you know, like, because we fitted him for reading glasses. There's a few times he has his glasses on while he's working. Mm-hmm. And he wanted, I believe they were like Ray-Ban, the kind of like 1960s, like those like Malcolm X kind of horn.
Like the Wayfarer style or something.
Yeah. So he was pretty adamant about that, which I think was a great choice. And then, yeah, his watch, I remember he really wanted a silver band. That was like the one thing that he was just like, I think my character would have that. What do you think? And I don't really like when it comes to something that is just aesthetic. And especially because those guys all pretty well wore the same costumes for the whole movie.
Right.
So it's like, so that's in a conversation with costumes as well to sort of be like, silver okay, and then silver's okay if that's what McAvoy wants. And
that's great.
Yeah. But then somebody like Mike Hanlon, so Isaiah, who's wonderful, lovely. He wanted his watch to be more, his watch band is more of like a military style watch. I remember we did have that discussion together about Mike Hanlon lives in this attic and he's just kind of this guy who just never really left Derry,
like so the town historian, right?
Yeah,
right.
And so he wants to his was a little bit of a nostalgia piece as well. So you know, there were those conversations as well. And then, you know, of course, then all the kids stuff, it's you know, all Casio and
sure.
You know, and sorry, I didn't answer your question about I wear a Casio watch. I wear and it's actually from the first It movie as from our background stock.
Wow.
It's just a tiny face, little digital Casio that I really like. That's what I wear.
That's got to have great memories for you from that. That's really, really cool.
It's just nice. It was really funny. There was a day that we were on set and I had my Casio. I had like an old pair of New Balances on. I was wearing like, I wear a lot of vintage clothing and I always wear a fanny pack when I'm on set. So I'm like, I could be an extra.
yeah, just put me on camera. I'm ready. Everyone's like, what are you talking about?
I'm like period accurate here. So yeah, that's
wear. Great. So what's it like now? Obviously, like we're living in kind of a different world. What's the difference between being on set now and just for context, we've kind of touched upon it, but you're working right now on the next Guillermo del Toro film. I think you said it's starring Bradley Cooper. And is it also Kate Blanchett? Is that right?
Yeah, we got Rooney Mara and Willem Dafoe and Ron Perlman and Toni Collette. Like it's stacked. It's pretty wonderful. It's like, you know, yeah, it's really wonderful.
And without saying too much, I think we've at least, we know it's a period piece and you're dealing somewhat with sourcing watches. I think we'll save that for when the movie comes out, obviously.
Sure.
But just in terms of like what it's like, being on set and if the film was interrupted at all, you know, for any reason, you know, during these times, like what's that been like for you?
Oh, it was definitely, you know, it was difficult when the show went down. Cause I think we were halfway done shooting it and you know, this was on March 13th that we officially took the hiatus. And they said, oh, we're going to be off for 2 weeks. And you're like, oh, this is so scary. And then it ended up being off for 6 months. Wow. So that was, you know, that's a hard blow when you're sort of in this like wonderful, whimsical world that Guillermo creates and you're able to be creative, work with people that you really, really admire and respect. And then that's just gone. And then, you know, paired with just everything that was happening globally and just sort of the worry of all that and the worry that it still exists right now. You know, it was definitely like a hard blow, but necessary to take that time off, you know, make sure everybody stayed safe. So, so we've been back shooting since September, and it's the first few weeks were pretty intense. You're getting used to, we wear face masks and face shields. So, you know, it's weird and so different. And, you know, it plays with your, if you're in a dark set, you know, you've got this reflective visor on, it's like sometimes right. You can't see or, And you also can't take like visual nonverbal cues from people, you know, like a smile from across the room goes a long way on when you're on your 10th hour, you know. But yeah, we've got, I know, like I can speak for my particular show, that we've got, you know, 10 hour shoot days, social distancing. We've got, there's a whole COVID team, that's always there. I get tested 5 times a week.
Wow.
Yeah, there's certain, people that it's either 3 times a week or 5, depending on what like zone you're placed in. So for me, because I speak directly to cast and I also handle, they call it hand to mouth, which I'm like, this is weird, but like, yeah. You know, I deal with cigarettes and drinks, sure. You know, luggage. It's like my hand is touching the handle, their hand. So I wear nitrile gloves a lot. Bradley jokes around with me, that it's the Maria Spesh is like the wearing the one right-handed nitrile glove, but then keeping my left hand not so I can text and I can take photos on the iPad of what we're doing. And so I've got the Maria Spesh, which he likes to joke around with me about.
It must be cool to have a moniker by Bradley Cooper attributed to you. I've got to say that sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah. He's, you know what? He's a lot of fun. Well, he's got a Cooper Spesh too. The Cooper Spesh is I've got for every time he smokes a cigarette, which is often, I have a water bottle that I have in a holster that is, so you can't see the contents of it, but I open the water bottle and point it to him and he'll do really fun, you know, depending on the mood or whatever, he'll kind of do a flourish and sure. Put the cigarette in. He does a slam dunk, which is like, you know, I say hoops. Just, it's just, amazing. That's the
Cooper Spesh. Great. That's so cool.
Yeah, so it's been really great. I'm very fortunate. We you know, even coming back with all these new standards, we still have fun every day. We are safe. I feel safe. A lot of hand washing stations. Sure. Any and all the PPE that you want. I'm really lucky. So
that's super important.
Yeah.
So one question before we go for you that just interests me, I think would be interesting. What is the hardest prop you've ever had to source, or if you weren't able to find it after all, what's one that just sort of is like a cloud over you, like I wish I could have got this, or something to that effect?
So you are gonna think that this is like such a ridiculous answer to such an awesome question, but the hardest prop that I have ever had to source was a keychain soccer ball to hang from a rearview mirror. You would think, and it's just one of those things. I know you want some amazing answer.
This is amazing. Because I want to know why this is so hard.
So hard. I was working on a show. I was the Toronto buyer for a show named Cardinal. And this was a couple of years ago. And that was, they're like, oh yeah. And you think, oh, I'll find that. I'll go to anywhere and find that. There's so many little shops here in Little Italy, they have soccer shops that are specialized.
Sure.
Go to a sports shop, or I'll order it online. It'll be super easy. And it ended up being like the last thing I had found so many other super weird things so easily. And there's one thing I couldn't find. And it was like, order it online from China, but you have to order 1,000 of them.
Right.
Or I could find them, but they in all the little soccer shops, but they'd be like team specific. And I was like, I just need black and white soccer right. ball. And I was racking my brain. I must have spent and my boss was like, why? I'd found everything else. And I said, I just can't find this one thing. And the director was adamant. And I haven't watched the show to see if it actually made it. And I wonder if it did. But I finally found what, believe it or not, I was at a box mall, and I went to Ardene, because I was like, when I was in high school and I would go there, they would sometimes have weird keychains. And sure enough, I found them, and it was buy one, get one free. I bought 15 of them. And I told my boss, I'm like, I know I spent, you know, whatever, $15
on right.
these, but keep these in your kit, because I promise you one day that this is going to make you money, because this was impossible to find.
That's great.
So, I ended up finding it, but it was
just put it on your own keychain now as well.
I didn't keep one. I should have. I think I just wanted to just get it, erase it from my memory of just sure. The hardest prop was this silly little keychain, but I've done I've found build parts for phasers and you know, badges, and it's just, yeah. So that's my, That's my hardest prop, was a soccer ball keychain. So anybody listening out there, if you have that, stockpile it, advertise it, sell it to a props person. Because
there's a lot of collectors of things listening to this show. So if the next collectible item is soccer ball keychains, then so be it. But you heard it here first.
There we go.
That's great. Listen, thanks so much, Maria. This was so much fun. I know that I really enjoyed this, and I hope everybody will enjoy listening to these stories. And you know, obviously, good luck with the rest of the production.
Thank you. Yeah, we're three more days and we're done.
Oh, so. That's great. Yeah, I think everyone's going to look forward to seeing that film, and we'll be sure to let everybody know when the date of release gets announced, and obviously when it's going to be in theaters, when we can look for a trailer, all of that fun stuff.
Great. Thank you so much. This was really fun.
Thank you to Maria Simonelli for recording with us. This week's episode was recorded in Los Angeles, New York, and Toronto, and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.